father's eyes forever. The Perry house was built on foot-high stilts, and a child might predictably fear what was under there, as many fear what is beneath the bed. But unlike those of most children, Perry's fears were not soothed, and they grew into an elaborate delusion that dead bodies were rising from a chamber beneath the floor. With so much to occupy his pathology right at home, why did Perry's mind wander to a famous woman who lived 1,500 miles away? Why did he believe he would find his peace by killing her? I would know soon enough. There was another prominent woman on his list, Sandra Day O'Connor, who'd just been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why did she get Perry's attention? Because no woman should be above a man, he later explained. He was used to powerful women. He'd been raised, as nearly all children are, by the most powerful woman in the world, his mother. Her power was misused, he felt, and his anger over it consumed him. Though the burns from the heater were long healed, Perry still wrapped his legs in ace bandages and never bared them in public. After returning from one of his stalking trips to Malibu, he beat his mother so badly that he was arrested and committed to a mental hospital. He quickly escaped and went right back to her house. Sheriff's deputies found him there, but his mother refused to let them take Perry back into custody. They persisted, but she resisted, and she prevailed. The next time deputies came to her home, the strong and domineering woman would be dead. Within a day of the murders, sociologist Walt Risler, a pioneering thinker in the field of predicting violence and a full-time consultant to our office for more than a decade, was on his way to Louisiana. There he interviewed family members, reviewed Perry's writings, and studied other evidence. Risler found the murder scene to be fertile ground for just the kind of madness deciphering he was so expert at. In a crib in the living room, Perry had piled an assortment of items: a crucifix, a pillow, three family photos face down, a wall plaque of the Virgin Mary, and a ceramic crab. This was a shrine of meaning to only Michael Perry until Risler began putting the pieces together. It was fair to assume that Perry was in one of three places, or somewhere between them: still in Louisiana in pursuit of local victims on his list, in Washington, D.C., stalking Sandra Day O'Connor, or in Malibu, likely in the thousands of acres of wilderness behind my client's home. Predicting that he might act out violently was simple. We'd done that even before the murders. The difficult questions to answer were how he would go about encountering his victims and how patient he would be. One late night, sitting in my office reviewing case material for the 100th time, I noted a report indicating that a book written by expert tracker Tom Brown was missing from the Jennings Parish Library. We knew that Perry had once checked out another book by Brown called The Search. Did Perry use the information in these books to escape detection while he lived secretly in the hills behind my client's home? Could he be just a few feet off a path as we walked obliviously by him? I knew whom to ask. Tom Brown had authored more than a dozen books on tracking and on nature, and he had been called in to search for dangerous men before. He wasn't anxious to do it again, but in our hour-long phone call, I convinced the wary and reluctant tracker to fly to Los Angeles and help us find Michael Perry. I picked him up at the airport, a wiry man with the quiet seriousness of Clint Eastwood. As I drove him to a waiting helicopter, he asked me questions about Perry. What kind of food does he like? Does he eat meat? Does he smoke? Tell me about his shoes. What kind of clothes does he wear? Tell me what his hair is like. Soon after arriving in Los Angeles, Brown was high above the Malibu hills surrounding my client's home, looking for any sign of Perry. Some firemen who had been shown a picture of Perry told us about a makeshift camp where they'd seen him some months before, and Tom overflew the area, pointing out spots the PSD agents then checked out on foot or horseback. When he searched on the ground, he was accompanied by armed PSD agents, and during the few days they spent together, he taught them some of what he knew about tracking. Brown was an absolute marvel. He could tell you where a person had walked, slept, even paused. His intuition was informed by a subtle and sometimes odd series of signals. Bent weeds, unsettled pebbles, shadows in the dust, and other details most people would look right past. Brown explained to me, "When somebody moves something in your house, you notice it. When somebody moves something in the woods, I notice it." In a backpack, one of the PSD agents carried a plaster cast of a shoe print taken from the dirt outside the murder scene. Occasionally, Brown would ask to have it brought out, and he'd compare it to some small ridge or depression in the dust. One afternoon, after I dropped Brown back at his hotel for a brief rest, I was told by radio that a Malibu resident a mile or so from my client's home had reported that a strange man had knocked on the door and asked questions about the magic movie star. He had headed up the hill on foot. I sped back to my client's house, knowing I'd get there before someone who was walking. When I arrived, several sheriff's deputies had joined two PSD people. We waited for about 30 minutes, and then the dogs began barking and running up the side of a hill. Everyone followed the dogs, and soon we could clearly see a man crawling through the brush. Some sheriff's deputies ran around behind him, and a police helicopter descended on him from above. In a flash of everyone's adrenaline, the intruder was on the ground, handcuffed and scuffling. I rushed up the hill to identify him for the deputies, hoping the search for Michael Perry had just ended. He was lifted up and seated on the dirt, looking right at me, and I recognized him immediately. But he wasn't Michael Perry. He was Warren P., another mentally ill pursuer whom we had interviewed years before and heard from occasionally. He was a lovesick man who hoped to marry my client. Though worthy of assessment, Warren was without sinister intent. He was more of a tragic figure than a dangerous one. His bad luck had carried him through years of effort and across thousands of miles, finally getting him to my client's home, the mecca of his romantic delusions, but on the worst possible afternoon for a visit. As he was walked to one of the sheriff's cars, he just kept repeating, "I had no idea the security would be this tight." Late the next night, three PSD agents searching the area around my client's property using some of Tom Brown's techniques found a suspicious-looking trail. They took me there and shone their flashlights parallel to the ground, showing me the patterns in the dust. I confess I didn't see what they saw, but we all followed along, through a gully and into the dark brush. We were silent, hoping to find Perry and on some level hoping not to. Ahead of us, we saw what even I could tell was a shelter built of gathered wood and twigs. We moved toward it, and as we got closer, we could see that nobody was there. Inside, we found evidence that it was indeed the home of someone pursuing my client. Amid the filthy clothes, we found the sleeve of one of her record albums. There was also a fork, some matches, and a crude weapon called a bola, made from two rocks tied to the end of a length of rope. As we crawled out of the hut, we could see through a clearing directly to where my client drove by each day on her way to and from home. If Michael Perry lived here, he likely surveilled her from this spot. It didn't take long before we heard the sounds of someone moving toward us through the brush. In the moonlight, we held our breath and watched a man approach. He had a mess of dark hair, more than I thought Perry could have grown in the time he'd been at large. The man was wearing a crown on his head made of twigs and leaves. Pounced on from all sides, he yelled out, "I'm the king! I'm the king!" as he was handcuffed. It wasn't Perry, but still another mentally ill pursuer. This one was here to watch over my client, his queen. Those two obsessed men living in my client's orbit during the Perry case made clear just how menacing public life can be. The next time you see one of those frequent tabloid reports about some stars being stalked by a crazed fan, you'll know how silly the hype is. You could choose almost any star almost any day and that story would be true. All that makes it news is that a tabloid needed a headline. Just as we might come upon Michael Perry in Malibu at any moment, Walt Risler and our investigator might find him in the reeds along the marshy waterways around Jennings Parish. Or some lucky, or, if not careful, unlucky state trooper might find him speeding in Chester Perry's Oldsmobile down the highway, or the U.S. Supreme Court police might find him wandering the halls of the historic building in search of Sandra Day O'Connor. Walt Risler, swimming deepest in the waters of Perry's delusions, concluded that Washington, D.C. and Malibu were a Perry-esque Sodom and Gomorrah. Weighing everything he'd learned about the case, Risler predicted that Perry was on his way to the nation's capital to kill Justice O'Connor. Based on this, I made contact with a seasoned Washington, D.C. homicide investigator named Tom Kilcullen and filled him in on the case and Risler's opinion. Kilcullen was a creative thinker who followed up on several leads in the Washington area. Our efforts in Malibu continued with daily interviews of people who might have seen Perry. We asked local shopkeepers to keep us informed of anyone inquiring about my client, and we urged special attentiveness at the Malibu Library. That's because a search of Grace and Chester Perry's phone records had revealed that their son had called them collect from there a few times during one of his visits to California. Another call on those records was more chilling. 6 months earlier, there'd been a small newspaper report about my clients frequenting a particular Beverly Hills shop. The phone records revealed that Perry had called his parents from the phone booth right outside that shop. We were dealing with a capable stalker. To learn what Perry might know about his own manhunt, I reviewed newspaper stories about the case. Scanning USA Today during those weeks was interesting because I would come to a headline like, "Suspect in 5 murders, and it wouldn't be Perry. Mass killer still at large, it wouldn't be Perry. Man wanted for family slayings, and it wouldn't be Perry. Only in America." For 11 days, teams in different parts of the country looked for a man who hated to be looked at. Until July 31st, when Risler's prediction proved correct. Police in Washington, D.C. received a call from a sleazy hotel. A guest had reportedly stolen a radio from another guest. An officer was dispatched to question the two derelict oddballs who had been annoying each other, and he concluded that nothing illegal had happened. The minor dispute call would be over once the officer completed the routine step of checking each man for any arrest warrants. He asked them to wait a moment while the results of the computer search came over his radio. The unimportant matter became the most important of that officer's career, because standing patiently in front of him was mass murderer Michael Perry. Within an hour, Detective Kilcullen called me and offered to let me talk to Perry, who was now in his custody. Just that quickly, the murderous stalker who had dominated my thoughts every moment for almost 2 weeks was on the other end of the phone, ready to chat. Without preparation, I stumbled into an interview with the nation's most wanted killer. We knew he'd been to my client's home, so I first asked him about that. He lied without hesitation, sounding like a fast-talking, streetwise con man. Perry. "I don't think I've ever been to her house, sir. I don't think so. I really don't." "Really?" "Right, I really don't." "Have you ever been to California at all?" "Well, I just went swimming at the beach, you know, and did some camping, that's all." Then, without my even asking, he told me how my client fit into his reasons for killing. Perry. "When she was in that movie, and whenever she turned around, she had quite a different face, you know. She looked like my mother back in 1961, you know? The face that my mother had. It was 1961. My mother walked into the room, and I was up way before anyone else, and my mother walked in, and she had this ugly-looking face, and I looked at this, and she turned her head and rubbed her shoulder. And that face in that movie reminded me of 1961. It ruined the whole thing, you know?" Perhaps he was recalling the day of the heater incident, burned into his memory as it was burned into his skin. He then quickly changed the subject and again denied ever having been to my client's home. It's common for criminals to avoid giving information someone wants. often precisely because it's wanted. But then he just gave up the lie and described the entrance to my client's home exactly. Perry. You know, they had like a little drive-in theater deal, the gate intercom. You know, you push the button, and a red light, part of the security program. And I had the impression that the house might have had an underground shelter, and it's a big place, and I rang the bell, and there was a camera out in front and everything. I didn't get that girl's attention, and she didn't get mine either. I just said, this can't be the place, you know, due to respect, that this was such an ancient place. That's a strong, strong feeling. Perry became quiet. When he next spoke, it was about the nature of obsession itself. In his unsophisticated way, he described the inside of his experience as accurately as any psychiatrist could hope to. Perry, I really don't want to bring it up. It passed my mind. She kind of creeped up, and nothing had ever stuck to my mind like that. And even, you know, even today, he drifted off into silence, and I waited quietly for him to speak again. Perry, on her special on HBO, I saw her eyes change color. Her eyes change color a lot. What was that like? I didn't like it at all. That girl might be a witch, you know. She may do some damage to me if she hears me saying this. I'm saying what I saw. It did look like my mother. I don't want to mess with it because I know it was a relief whenever I forgot about it. I weighed the fact that she was a movie star, and realistically speaking, her address being in a magazine is not right. So I'm kind of scared of this girl if I met her. Of course, I don't know what it would be like. I know it's a touchy situation with this girl. I've stayed up many nights thinking about it. What if you had seen her at the house?
I never did. And anyway, she has a boyfriend. But, you know, she asked of me, and so I did, so that's about it. But I don't want to get too personal. I'm under arrest right now. I just want you to know that. They called the folks back home, and there's been some sort of big accident, some theft or something like that, which I didn't do.
Perry got quiet again. It was clear that the man who tried to exorcise one of his demons by shooting his mother in the face still wasn't free of it. You don't like this whole subject, do you?
No, I don't. The bad thing about it was that she turned around and had that ugly face. The face was completely different from the one she had had. I mean, it was a disaster that she looked like her. It was terrible, you know? And I turned off the TV and I left.
I don't want to talk too much about it because, man, it took a lot of my time after I saw that. I said, this is too much. It took a lot of my time, and I didn't want it anymore. His voice drifted off, and then he hung up. I sat at my desk in disbelief. The emergency that had consumed nearly every hour of every person in my company had just ended, not with a stakeout or a gunfight or a SWAT team, but with a phone call. The man I had tried to know and understand through every means I could find had just told me outright why he had stalked my client and why he wanted to kill her. I walked into the TAM office, which was bustling with activity regarding the case, and said, I just got off the phone with Michael Perry. That didn't make sense to anybody, but it wasn't funny enough to be a joke. I flew to D.C. the next morning to learn anything of relevance to the case and to gain information that would help with the prosecution, since our next job would be to help ensure that Perry was convicted. I'd been in regular touch with the Jennings Parish prosecutor, who was meeting me in D.C. When I arrived, Kilcullen told me Perry's car had been found and was being held at a nearby tow yard. We drove over together to look at it and see what evidence it held. Chester Perry's green Oldsmobile was dusty from its long drive. An officer looked in the window at the front seat and then recoiled a bit.
It's covered in blood, he said.
Sure enough, there was a dark, pulpy liquid sticking to the fabric upholstery. As we opened the door, I saw watermelon seeds on the floor. It wasn't blood on the seat. It was watermelon juice. Rather than pause to eat somewhere,
Perry had bought a watermelon and eaten it with his right hand as he sped along the highway toward D.C. Perry had chosen to stay at a cheap little place called the Annex Hotel, which was about a mile and a half from the Supreme Court. When we went there, it became clear what he had spent most of his money on. He had turned room 136 into something that stunned us all. A bizarre museum of the media age, a work of pop art that connected violence and madness and television. Into that tiny room, Perry had crammed 9 television sets, all plugged in, all tuned to static. On one, he had scrawled the words, "My body," in red marker. Several of the sets had giant eyes drawn on the screens. One had my client's name written boldly along the side. The Louisiana detective in charge of the Perry homicides, Irwin Trahan, came to D.C. to transport Perry back home for trial. Often such prisoners are flown on commercial planes or on Con Air, the nickname for the U.S. Marshal's jet fleet. But Trahan and his partner had decided to drive Perry back to Louisiana. This unusual trio sped along the same highways Perry had driven to get to D.C., checking into motels along the way. The detectives took turns staying awake to watch Perry, who didn't sleep at all. At the close of their 2-day trip, Perry asked them to pass a message to me. It was about my client. "You better keep an eye on her 24 hours a day." In an irony I wouldn't recognize for many years, Perry also told the detectives that if his case ever went before the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Sandra Day O'Connor, "I wouldn't have a chance then because that's a woman." His case did eventually go before the Supreme Court. A while after Perry was back in Louisiana, we arranged for Walt Risler to interview him in jail to follow up on his sinister warnings about my client. An agitated Perry explained to him, "Tell her to stay away from Greece. That's all I want to say to you now, man. I'm feeling sick, so sick, my head is just filled with vomit." To keep the interview from ending, Risler asked about one of Perry's favorite topics, television. Perry responded, "Man, TV is really fucked up lately. I don't know what it means. After a while, it got so that the only sense I could make of television was by watching channels with nothing on. I could read them and make more sense than what was happening on the programs." He then asked his attorney to leave so he could speak with Risler in private. He took Risler's hands in his and explained that if he didn't get out of jail, there would be hell to pay. If he was executed, it would trigger the explosion of an atomic missile hidden in the swamps near town. "So you see, getting me out of here is important to everyone. I'm just trying to save lives." Perry stood up to end the interview. "Oh man, my head is filled with vomit. You can just see how fucked up my head is, can't you, from the things I think?" Perry was not faking insanity. This was the real thing. When I got back to Los Angeles, there was a kind letter from Justice O'Connor thanking me for my help and lamenting the fact that there are people in this country who are sufficiently unstable to constitute genuine threats to others. A few years later, after the Supreme Court adopted the Mosaic program I designed, I met with Justice O'Connor in her office. Michael Perry, by then convicted of the 5 murders and sentenced to death, had come back into her life in an interesting way. Prison officials ordered doctors to give Perry medication so that he would be lucid enough to know what was happening on the day he was executed. The doctors refused, reasoning that since the medication was being given just so he could be killed, it was not in their patient's best interest. The matter went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in one of history's most impartial decisions, the justices ruled that the murderer who had stalked one of them could not be forced to take the medication just to be executed. Michael Perry is alive today because of that ruling. The Perry case shows that even the most public of crimes are motivated by the most personal issues. Though the odds are overwhelming that you'll ever appear on the death list of some mass killer, I've discussed the case here to add to your understanding of violence and to reveal the human truth in the sensational stories we see in the news. Reports of such murders on TV, presented in one dimension, without perspective, and without the kind of detail you've just read, usually do little more than add unwarranted fear to people's lives. And people hardly need more of that. Chapter 15. The Gift of Fear. Fears are educated into us and can, if we wish, be educated out. Carl A. Menninger. We all know there are plenty of reasons to fear people from time to time. The question is, what are those times? Far too many people are walking around in a constant state of vigilance, their intuition misinformed about what really poses danger. It needn't be so. When you honor accurate intuitive signals and evaluate them without denial, believing that either the favorable or the unfavorable outcome is possible, you need not be wary, for you will come to trust that you'll be notified if there is something worthy of your attention. Fear will gain credibility because it won't be applied wastefully. When you accept the survival signal as a welcome message and quickly evaluate the environment or situation, fear stops in an instant. Thus, trusting intuition is the exact opposite of living in fear. In fact, the role of fear in your life lessons, as your mind and body come to know that you will listen to the quiet wind chime and have no need for klaxons. Real fear is a signal intended to be very brief, a mere servant of intuition. But though few would argue that extended, unanswered fear is destructive, millions choose to stay there. They may have forgotten or never learned that fear is not an emotion like sadness or happiness, either of which might last a long while. It is not a state like anxiety. True fear is a survival signal that sounds only in the presence of danger. Yet, unwarranted fear has assumed a power over us that it holds over no other creature on earth. In The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker explains that animals, in order to survive, have had to be protected by fear responses. Some Darwinians believe that the early humans who were most afraid were most likely to survive. The result, says Becker, is the emergence of man as we know him, a hyper-anxious animal who constantly invents reasons for anxiety even when there are none. It need not be this way. I learned this again on a recent visit to Fiji, where there is less fear in the entire republic than there is at some intersections in Los Angeles. One morning, on a peaceful, hospitable island called Vanua Levu, I took a few-mile walk down the main road. It was lined on both sides with low ferns. Occasionally, over the sound of the quiet ocean to my left, I'd hear an approaching car or truck. Heading back toward the plantation where I was staying, I closed my eyes for a moment as I walked. Without thinking at first, I just kept them closed because I had an intuitive assurance that walking down the middle of this road with my eyes closed was a safe thing to do. When I analyzed this odd feeling, I found it to be accurate. The island has no dangerous animals and no assaultive crime. I would feel the ferns touch my legs if I angled to either side of the road, and I'd hear an approaching vehicle in plenty of time to simply open my eyes. To my surprise, before the next car came along, I had walked more than a mile with my eyes closed, trusting that my senses and intuition were quietly vigilant. When it comes to survival signals, our minds have already done their best work by the time we try to figure things out. In effect, we've reached the finish line and handily won the race before even hearing the starting pistol, if we just listen without debate. Admittedly, that blind walk was in Fiji, but what about in a big American city? Not long ago, I was in an elevator with an elderly woman who was heading down to an underground parking garage after business hours. Her keys were protruding through her fingers to form a weapon, which also displayed her fear. She was afraid of me when I got into the elevator, as she is likely afraid of all men she encounters when she is in that vulnerable situation. I understand her fear, and it saddens me, that millions of people feel it so often. The problem, however, is that if one feels fear of all people all the time, there is no signal reserved for the times when it's really needed. A man who gets into the elevator on another floor and hence wasn't following her. A man who gives her no undue attention, who presses a button for a floor other than the one she has selected, who is dressed appropriately, who is calm, who stands a suitable distance from her, is not likely to hurt her without giving some signal. Fear of him is a waste, so don't create it. I strongly recommend caution and precaution. But many people believe, and we are even taught, that we must be extra alert to be safe. In fact, this usually decreases the likelihood of perceiving hazard and thus reduces safety. Alertly looking around while thinking, "Someone could jump out from behind that hedge. Maybe there's someone hiding in that car," replaces perception of what actually is happening with imaginings of what could happen. We are far more open to every signal when we don't focus on the expectation of specific signals. You might think a small animal that runs across a field in a darting crisscross fashion is fearful, even though there isn't any danger. In fact, scurrying is a strategy, a precaution, not a reaction to a fear signal. Precautions are constructive, whereas remaining in a state of fear is destructive. It can also lead to panic, and panic itself is usually more dangerous than the outcome we dread. Rock climbers and long-distance ocean swimmers will tell you it isn't the mountain or the water that kills. It is panic. Meg is a woman who works with violently inclined mental patients every day. She rarely feels fear at her job, but away from work, she tells me, she feels panic every night as she walks from her car to her apartment. When I offer the unusual suggestion that she'd actually be safer if she relaxed during that walk, she says, "That's ridiculous. If I relaxed, I'd probably get killed." She argues that she must be acutely alert to every possible risk. Possibilities, I explained, are in the mind, while safety is enhanced by perception of what is outside the mind, perception of what is happening, not what might happen. But Meg insists that her nightly fear will save her life, and even as she steadfastly defends the value of her terror, I know she wants to be free of it. DeBecker: "When do you feel the fear?" Meg: "As I park my car."
"Is it the same every night?"
"Yes, and then if I hear a noise or something, it gets 10 times worse, so I have to stay extra alert. Living in Los Angeles, I have to stay alert all the time."
Note her reference to Los Angeles, a satellite. I explain that if she's scared to death every night, focused intently on what might happen, then no signal is reserved for when there actually is risk that needs her attention. Ideally, when there is fear, we look around, follow the fear, ask what we are perceiving. If we are looking for some specific expected danger, we are less likely to see the unexpected danger. I urge that she pay relaxed attention to her environment, rather than paying rapt attention to her imagination. I know Meg is feeling anxious, and that is a signal of something, though not danger in this case. I ask her what risks she faces as she walks from her car each night.
"Isn't that a dumb question coming from you? I mean, there are so many risks. Los Angeles is a very dangerous city, not a place I choose to live."
"But you do choose to live here."
"No, I have to. I'm trapped by this job. I have to live here. And it's so dangerous. People are killed here all the time, and I know that. So I'm afraid when I walk to my apartment. Terrified, actually. And I should be."
"Certainly anything could happen to anyone any time. But since you've made that walk more than 1,000 times without injury, the terror you feel is likely a signal of something other than danger. How do you normally communicate with yourself?" An agitated Meg says she doesn't understand my question, but that she doesn't want to discuss it anymore. She'll think about it overnight. When she calls the following afternoon, she not only understands my question about how she communicates with herself, but has found her answer.
She agrees that her intuition is indeed communicating something to her, and it isn't imminent danger. It is that she does not want to stay in Los Angeles or in her job. Her nightly walk from her car into her apartment is simply the venue for her inner voice to speak most loudly. Every day my work brings me into close contact with people who are afraid, anxious, or just worrying. My first duty is to figure out which it is. If it's real fear they feel, there is important information for me to glean, possibly relevant to safety. There are two rules about fear that, if you accept them, can improve your use of it, reduce its frequency, and literally transform your experience of life. That's a big claim, I know, but don't be afraid to consider it with an open mind. Rule number one, the very fact that you fear something is solid evidence that it is not happening. Fear summons powerful predictive resources that tell us what might come next. It's that which might come next that we fear, what might happen, not what is happening now. An absurdly literal example helps demonstrate this. If you stand near the edge of a high cliff, you might fear getting too close. If you stand right at the edge, you no longer fear getting too close, you now fear falling. Edward Gorey gives us his dark-humored but accurate take on the fact that if you do fall, you no longer fear falling. You fear landing. The suicide, as she is falling, illuminated by the moon, regrets her act and finds appalling the thought she will be dead so soon. Panic, the great enemy of survival, can be perceived as an unmanageable kaleidoscope of fears. It can be reduced through embracing the second rule. Rule number two, what you fear is rarely what you think you fear. It is what you link to fear. Take anything about which you have ever felt profound fear and link it to each of the possible outcomes. When it's real fear, it will either be in the presence of danger or it will link to pain or death. When we get a fear signal, our intuition has already made many connections. To best respond, bring the links into consciousness and follow them to their high-stakes destination, if they lead there. When we focus on one link only, say fear of someone walking toward us on a dark street, instead of fear of being harmed by someone walking toward us on a dark street, the fear is wasted. That's because many people will approach us. Only a very few might harm us. Surveys have shown that ranking very close to the fear of death is the fear of public speaking. Why would someone feel profound fear deep in his or her stomach about public speaking, which is so far from death? Because it isn't so far from death when we link it. Those who fear public speaking actually fear the loss of identity that attaches to performing badly. And that is firmly rooted in our survival needs. For all social animals, from ants to antelopes, identity is the pass card to inclusion, and inclusion is the key to survival. If a baby loses its identity as the child of its parents, a possible outcome is abandonment. For a human infant, that means death. As adults, without our identity as a member of the tribe or village, community or culture, a likely outcome is banishment and death. So the fear of getting up and addressing 500 people at the annual convention of professionals in your field is not just the fear of embarrassment. It's linked to the fear of being perceived as incompetent, which is linked to the fear of loss of employment, loss of home, loss of family, your ability to contribute to society, your value, in short, your identity, and your life. Linking an unwarranted fear to its ultimate terrible destination usually helps alleviate that fear. Though you may find that public speaking can link to death, you'll see that it would be a long and unlikely trip. Apply these two rules to the fear that a burglar might crash into your living room. First, the fear itself can actually be perceived as good news because it confirms that the dreaded outcome is not occurring right now. Since life has plenty of hazards that come upon us without warning, we could welcome fear with Thank you, God, for a signal I can act on. More often, however, we apply denial first, trying to see if perhaps we can just think it away. Remember, fear says something might happen. If it does happen, we stop fearing it and start to respond to it, manage it, surrender to it. Or we start to fear the next outcome we predict might be coming. If a burglar does crash into the living room, we no longer fear that possibility. We now fear what he might do next. Whatever that may be, while we fear it, it is not happening. Let's go one step deeper in this exploration of fear. In the 1960s, there was a study done that sought to determine which single word has the greatest psychological impact on people. Researchers tested reactions to words like spider, snake, death, rape, incest, murder. It was the word shark that elicited the greatest fear response. But why do sharks, which human beings come in contact with so rarely, frighten us so profoundly? The seeming randomness of their strike is part of it. So is the lack of warning, the fact that such a large creature can approach silently and separate body from soul so dispassionately. To the shark, we are without identity. We are no more than meat, and to human beings, the loss of identity is a type of death all by itself. In his book, Great White Shark, Jean-Michel Cousteau calls the shark the most frightening animal on earth. But there is, of course, an animal far more dangerous. Scientists marvel at the predatory competence of the great white, praising its speed, brute strength, sensory acuity, and apparent determination. But man is a predator of far more spectacular ability. The shark doesn't have dexterity, guile, deceit, cleverness, or disguise. It also doesn't have our brutality. For man does things to man that sharks couldn't dream of doing. Deep in ourselves, we know this, so occasional fear of another human being is natural. As with the shark attack, randomness and lack of warning are the attributes of human violence we fear most. But you know that human violence is rarely random and rarely without warning. Admittedly, danger from humans is more complicated than danger from sharks. After all, everything you need to know about how to be safe from sharks can be spoken in 5 words. Don't go in the ocean. Everything you need to know about how to be safe from people is in you too, enhanced by a lifetime of experience, and hopefully better organized by this book. We may choose to sit in the movie theater indulging in the fear of unlikely dangers now and again, but our fear of people, which can be a blessing, is often misplaced. Since we live every day with the most frightening animal on earth, understanding how fear works can dramatically improve our lives. People use the word fear rather loosely, but to put it in its proper relation to panic, worry, and anxiety, recall the overwhelming fear that possessed Kelly when she knew a rapist intended to kill her. Though people say of a frightening experience, I was petrified. Aside from those times when being still is a strategy, real fear is not paralyzing. It is energizing. Rodney Fox learned this when he faced one of man's deepest fears. I was suddenly aware of moving through the water faster than I ever had before. Then I realized I was being pulled down by a shark which had hold of my chest. As the powerful predator took him from the surface, a far more powerful force compelled Rodney to caress the shark's head and face, searching for its eyes. He plunged his thumbs deep into the only soft tissue he found. The shark let go of him immediately, but Rodney embraced it and held on tight so it couldn't turn around for another strike. After what seemed like a long ride downward, he kicked away from it and swam through a cloud of red to the surface. Fear was pumping blood into Rodney's arms and legs and using them to do things he would never have done on his own. He would never have decided to fight with a great white shark, but because fear didn't give it a second thought, he survived. Rodney's wild, reckless action and Kelly's quiet, breathless action were both fueled by the same coiled-up energy, real
fear. Take a moment to conjure that feeling and recognize how different it is from worry, anxiety, and panic. Even the strongest worry could not get you to fight with a shark or follow your would-be murderer silently down a hallway. Recently, I was asked to speak to a group of corporate employees about their safety. But, as is often the case, it quickly became a discussion about fear. Before I began, several people said, "Please talk to Celia. She's been looking forward to this meeting for weeks." Celia, it turned out, was eager to tell me about her dread of being followed, a topic her co-workers had heard a lot about. When people come to me in fear of a stranger, a co-worker, a spouse, a fan, my first step is always to determine if it actually is a fear as opposed to a worry or a phobia. This is fairly simple since, as I noted above, real fear occurs in the presence of danger and will always easily link to pain or death. To learn if Celia was reacting to a fear signal, which is not voluntary, or if she was worrying, which is voluntary, I asked if she feared being followed right then, right in the room where we sat. She laughed. "No, of course not. I fear it when I'm walking alone from my office to my car at night. I park in a big gated lot, and mine is always the only car left because I work the latest, and the lot is empty and it's dead silent." Since she had given me no indication of actual risk, her dread was not the fear signal of nature, but the worry only humans indulge in. To get her to link the fear, I asked what about being followed scared her. "Well, it's not the following that scares me, it's the being caught. I'm afraid somebody will grab me from behind and pull me into a car. They could do anything to me since I'm the last one here." She launched this satellite about working the latest several times. Since worry is a choice, people do it because it serves them in some way. The worry about public speaking may serve its host by giving him or her an excuse never to speak in public or an excuse to cancel or to do poorly, "because I was so scared." But how did Celia's worry serve Celia? People will always tell you what the real issue is, and in fact, Celia already had. I asked why she couldn't just leave work earlier each evening. "If I did, everybody would think I was lazy." So Celia was concerned about losing her identity as the employee who always worked the longest. Her frequent discussions of hazard and fear were guaranteed to quickly carry any conversation to the fact that she worked the latest, and that is how the worry served her. The wise words of FDR, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," might be amended by nature to, "There is nothing to fear unless and until you feel fear." Worry, wariness, anxiety, and concern all have a purpose, but they are not fear. So any time your dreaded outcome cannot be reasonably linked to pain or death, and it isn't a signal in the presence of danger, then it really shouldn't be confused with fear. It may well be something worth trying to understand and manage, but worry will not bring solutions. It will more likely distract you from finding solutions. In the original form of the word, to worry someone else was to harass, strangle, or choke them. Likewise, to worry oneself is a form of self-harassment. To give it less of a role in our lives, we must understand what it really is. Worry is the fear we manufacture. It is not authentic. If you choose to worry about something, have at it, but do so knowing it's a choice. Most often, we worry because it provides some secondary reward. There are many variations, but a few of the most popular follow. Worry is a way to avoid change. When we worry, we don't do anything about the matter. Worry is a way to avoid admitting powerlessness over something, since worry feels like we're doing something. Prayer also makes us feel like we're doing something, and even the most committed agnostic will admit that prayer is more productive than worry. Worry is a cloying way to have connection with others, the idea being that to worry about someone shows love. The other side of this is the belief that not worrying about someone means you don't care about them. As many worried about people will tell you, worry is a poor substitute for love or for taking loving action.
Worry is a protection against future disappointment. After taking an important test, for example, a student might worry about whether he failed. If he can feel the experience of failure now, rehearse it, so to speak, by worrying about it, then failing won't feel as bad when it happens. But there's an interesting trade-off. Since he can't do anything about it at this point anyway, would he rather spend 2 days worrying, then learn he failed, or spend those same 2 days not worrying, and then learn he failed? Perhaps most importantly, would he want to learn he had passed the test and spent 2 days of anxiety for nothing? In Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman concludes that worrying is a sort of magical amulet that some people feel wards off danger. They believe that worrying about something will stop it from happening. He also correctly notes that most of what people worry about has a low probability of occurring, because we tend to take action about those things we feel are likely to occur. This means that very often the mere fact that you are worrying about something is a predictor that it isn't likely to happen. The relationship between real fear and worry is analogous to the relationship between pain and suffering. Pain and fear are necessary and valuable components of life. Suffering and worry are destructive and unnecessary components of life. Great humanitarians, remember, have worked to end suffering, not pain. After decades of seeing worry in all its forms, I've concluded that it hurts people much more than it helps. It interrupts clear thinking, wastes time, and shortens life. When worrying, ask yourself, how does this serve me? And you may well find that the cost of worrying is greater than the cost of changing. To be freer of fear, and yet still get its gift, there are 3 goals to strive for. They aren't easy to reach, but it's worth trying. 1. When you feel fear, listen. 2. When you don't feel fear, don't manufacture it. 3. If you find yourself creating worry, explore and discover why. Just as some people are quick to predict the worst, there are others who are reluctant to accept that they might actually be in some danger. This is often caused by the false belief that if we identify and name risk, that somehow invites or causes it to happen. This thinking says, if we don't see it and don't accept it, it is prevented from happening. Only human beings can look directly at something, have all the information they need to make an accurate prediction, perhaps even momentarily make the accurate prediction, and then say that it isn't so. One of my clients is a corporation whose New York headquarters has an excellent safety and security program. All doors into their suite of offices are kept locked. Adjacent to each entry door is a plate over which employees wave a magnetic card to gain ready access. The president of the firm asked me to speak to an employee, Arlene, who persistently refused to carry her access card. She complained that the cards scare people because they bring to mind the need for security. Call this fear of fear. Yes, she agreed, since many employees work late at night, there is a need for a security program, but the cards and locked doors should be replaced with a guard in the lobby because the cards make the place seem like an armed camp and they scare people. Trying to link this fear of the cards to pain or death, I asked Arlene what it is that people fear. The cards increase the danger, she explained, because their presence says there's something here worth taking. Could it be, I asked, that the cards actually reduce fear and risk, since their use means that the offices are not accessible to just anyone off the street? No, she told me, people don't think that way. They'd rather not be reminded of the risk. Arlene explained that metal detectors at airports conjure the specter of hijacking as opposed to reassuring people. Tamper-proof packaging does not add comfort, it adds apprehension, and, she noted, it's just an invitation to tamper. At the end of her confident presentation about human nature and why the cards scared people, I asked if she agreed that there could be hazard to employees if the doors were left unlocked.
Of course I do. I was assaulted one night when I worked late at my last job. The doors weren't kept locked there, and this guy walked right in. There was nobody else in the whole building, so don't tell me about danger.
With that story, Arlene revealed who was afraid of the cards. She also clearly stated her philosophy for managing her fear. Don't tell me about danger. Later, after questioning me extensively about safety in her apartment and on the subway and while shopping and when dating, she agreed to use the cards. Occasionally, we answer fears that aren't calling. Other times, we ignore those that are. And sometimes, like physician Bill McKenna, we fall somewhere in the middle. My wife, Linda, was on a business trip, so I took the girls out to dinner. We got home late. I made sure that they got to sleep and then got into bed myself. As I was dozing off, I heard a noise downstairs, which for some reason really scared me. It wasn't that it was loud, and I don't even recall exactly what it sounded like, but I absolutely couldn't shake it. So I got out of bed and went downstairs to be sure everything was all right. I made a quick walk around and then went back to bed. A half hour later, I heard a sound so quiet that I still don't know how it woke me. It was the sound of someone else's breathing. I turned on the light, and there was this guy standing in the middle of the room with my gun in his hand and our CD player under his arm. If Bill's mission on his walk downstairs was to be sure everything was all right, as he put it, then he succeeded admirably. If, though, it was to answer the survival signal, to accept the gift of fear, he failed. When he heard that noise downstairs, if he had consciously linked the fear he felt to its possible dangerous outcomes, as his intuition had already done, he would have recognized that the stakes were high, and he might have conducted his search with the goal of finding risk as opposed to the goal of finding nothing. Had he responded to his fear with respect, he would have found the intruder before the intruder found his gun. If he had said, in effect, "Since I feel fear, I know there is some reason, so what is it?" then he could have brought into consciousness what his intuition already knew and what he later told me. The living room light was on when he got home. The cat had somehow gotten outside and was waiting on the porch. An unusual old car was parked near his driveway, its engine clinking as it cooled, and on and on. Only in the context of all these factors did that noise, which would have been inconsequential at another time, cause fear. Bill McKenna and his daughters, 4 and 5 years old, were held at gunpoint by the intruder for more than an hour. The man let the girls sit on the floor of the master bedroom and watch a videotape of Beauty and the Beast. He told Bill that he needed time to make what he called the most difficult decision of my life. He asked, "Have you ever had a really tough problem?" And Bill nodded. Bill told me he was alert until the intruder left, but that he did not feel any fear whatsoever. "When someone's already got you at gunpoint, it's too late for fear. I had more important things to focus on, like keeping the girls calm by showing them that I was okay, and keeping this guy calm. Anyway, my fear had come and gone, and after a while, that guy had come and gone too." Bill's lack of dread, just like his original fear on hearing the noise, made sense. First, the burglar didn't bring a gun with him, so he was not an intruder who expected or was prepared to kill. Second, his goal was fairly lightweight theft, as evidenced by the CD player he'd taken. Finally, he spoke his conscience when he said he was weighing the most difficult decision of his life. A man willing to kill would have little need to discuss his personal exploration of right and wrong with his intended victims. In fact, he would dehumanize and distance his victims, certainly not bring them into his deliberations. The intruder not only left, but he left the CD player. He did the family another favor, too. He took the gun, which now won't be available to some more dangerous intruder in the future. Bill is not replacing it. Bill let the girls watch the rest of the movie before putting them back to bed. They still recall the night the policeman with the gun visited. And it's not a traumatic story they tell.
They didn't sense fear in Bill because, just as he told me, he didn't feel it.
Real fear is objective, but it's clear that we are not. Meg was afraid of being killed, and Celia was afraid of being followed, even when there was nobody there. Arlene was afraid of access cards, even though they added to her safety. Bill was not afraid of an intruder, even when the man was standing in his bedroom with a gun. This all proves, as I noted early in the book, that we have odd ways of evaluating risk. Smoking kills more people every day than lightning does in a decade, but there are people who calm their fear of being struck by lightning during a storm by smoking a cigarette. It isn't logical, but logic and anxiety rarely go together. I recently met a middle-aged couple from Florida who had just obtained licenses to carry concealed handguns. The man explained why.
Because if some guy walks into a restaurant and opens fire, like happened at Luby's in Texas, I want to be in a position to save lives.
Of course, there are plenty of things he could carry on his belt that would be far more likely to save lives in a restaurant. An injection of adrenaline would treat anaphylactic shock, the potentially lethal allergic reaction to certain foods. Or he could carry a small sharp tube to give emergency tracheotomies to people who are choking to death. When I asked him if he carried one of those, he said,
"I could never stick something into a person's throat."
But he could send a piece of lead into a person's flesh like a rocket. Statistically speaking, the man and his wife are far more likely to shoot each other than to shoot some criminal. But his anxiety wasn't caused by fear of death. If it were, he would shed the excess 40 pounds likely to bring on a heart attack. His anxiety is caused by fear of people, and by the belief that he cannot predict violence. Anxiety, unlike real fear, is always caused by uncertainty. It is caused, ultimately, by predictions in which you have little confidence. When you predict that you will be fired from your job and you are certain the prediction is correct, you don't have anxiety about being fired. You might have anxiety about the things you can't predict with certainty, such as the ramifications of losing the job. Predictions in which you have high confidence free you to respond, adjust, feel sadness, accept, prepare, or to do whatever is needed. Accordingly, anxiety is reduced by improving your predictions, thus increasing your certainty. It's worth doing because the word anxiety, like worry, stems from a root that means to choke. And that is just what it does to us. Our imaginations can be the fertile soil in which worry and anxiety grow from seeds to weeds. But when we assume the